We're going to be in Exodus chapter 2 this morning. Exodus chapter 2. We're continuing our study on the book of Exodus. We'll probably be here a little while, but take some breaks here and there. Exodus chapter 2. This morning, the title of my message is Quiet Providence. Quiet Providence. I don't know about you, but on some of these winter days, it's really nice to see sunshine, right? It felt like 2 weeks in a row is just like dreary, windy, not much sunlight in the sky. But it does me good to see sunshine. And winter can be a hard time on people. It really can. I remember one particular winter was very difficult for me. I was just going through a tough time. There was a lot of uncertainty in my life. I was dealing with some anxiety, some depression, and it was a particularly rough winter. And as I was driving home on one of those days, it was one of those just cold, 25 degrees, blustery wind, you know, cut right through you kind of days. And I was driving home down in the valley of Blacksburg. I was driving home from one of my friend's house, and I heard this song come on the radio, and it was called In the Waiting. And the lyrics really verbalized how I felt. I wasn't able to put how I felt into words, but it kind of did that for me. And the words, some of the lyrics go like this. It says, I've seen the blooms of spring, new life and everything, but now it seems so gray, bright colors fade away. This winter seems much longer and colder than before. And that was definitely true of my life at the time. This morning, I'm convinced that there's someone or someone's that are here this morning, and that's kind of the spot that you're in, that you just kind of feel beat up and beat down with life. And if that is the case this morning, I want to speak particularly to you this morning from this passage, because I can feel where you're at. God is sovereign, right? That's going to be a huge theme through the book of Exodus. We're going to see God work and do miraculous, awesome things. The details, so we talk about the sovereignty of God, and the details of how God brings about his sovereign plans is another theological term called providence. Okay, so you have sovereignty, meaning God is in control over everything. He's the ruler over everything. And providence has to do with how he brings those details together. All right, the main point this morning is the providence of God is often quiet. The providence of God is often quiet. It's important that we believe right things about God. You know, if we have unrealistic expectations of God, that, you know, every morning when we wake up, he's going to audibly speak to us or speak to us in such a clear manner that it can't be confused. That's not always the case for Christians. You know, it seems like, at least in my life, that most of the time, my walk with God is more difficult than what I wish it was. And God's not as obvious and as plain in my life as I wish he was. So when we believe wrong things about God, what it does is it builds up these wrong expectations. And what happens when we have wrong expectations? It can go into a big spiral. If we have unrealistic expectations, guess what? We're going to have unmet expectations. And when we have unmet expectations, that's going to lead to depression. And intensifies as we still think about those unrealistic expectations. And then depression eventually is going to lead to despair. So this is an important truth about God, that oftentimes his providence is subtle, is quiet. It's not so easy to pick up. I want you to recall the events that have brought us here to Exodus chapter 2. Think back to Genesis. Joseph, one of the 12 sons of Jacob, there's this, you know, incredible story of God's providence in his life. Providence is a theme that's already been found in the first five books of the Bible up to this point. So Joseph went from the pit. Remember, he's thrown to the pit by his brothers. He went from the pit to the prison and to eventually the palace. And he was appointed in Egypt as a top-tier advisor to Pharaoh. And what happens? A famine comes into the land, but God had given Joseph this supernatural wisdom to where he had already instructed the Egyptians that they needed to gather and collect food to put in storehouses. And so when this famine came, they were prepared. And so people groups all across the ancient Near East came to Egypt in order to get food. One particular group made the trip southwest to Egypt, and it was this small nomadic clan, the family of Jacob. And so in the providence of God, who shows up on Joseph's doorstep basically begging for food, dependent on Joseph for food? It's his brothers, the very ones that had taken him, that were jealous of him and that threw him into the pit. Nobody had a clue what was going to happen. But God, what he had done in his providence is that he had sent one of the family members, one of those brothers, he had sent him ahead to Egypt long before the famine ever came. And God, in his providence, was protecting and preserving the seed of Jacob long before anyone ever saw this threat coming to their family. That's the providence of God. All right, so God, in his providence, brought the children of Israel down to Egypt. But now, in Exodus 1 and 2, God, in his providence, is starting the wheels in motion that's going to take this family that has grown and multiplied and flourished. He's going to take them out of Egypt, and he's going to take them back to the land that he promised to their ancestor Abraham years before. And even here in Exodus 2, God's providence is often quiet, and it happens right under our noses. It's not that God is not working in our lives, it's that we usually don't recognize it. Because God's providence is usually working right under our nose. So, the author, Moses, tells the story. And it goes like this. There once was a Hebrew man that married a Hebrew wife. They were both from the same tribe. They were both descendants of one of those 12 brothers. The specific brother's name was Levi. Now, at that time, the tribe of Levi was nothing. There was nothing special about them. Nothing more special of the tribe of Levi than Simeon or Issachar, whatever. And in fact, Jacob, on his deathbed, didn't really expect much to come out of the tribe of Levi. He recognized that Levi had been kind of a hothead, and that the Levites, his descendants, would end up kind of serving the other tribes. So Jacob himself didn't expect a whole lot from this tribe. But this man and woman, they had children already, probably at least, we know at least a couple kids. But the woman becomes pregnant again. And now, if you remember what we talked about last week, we really focused on the sanctity of life from the end of Exodus chapter 1. And we saw this edict that Pharaoh had put out persecuting all the Israelites, but specifically the baby boys. See, Pharaoh had made this command that all the baby boys that were born to the children of Israel were to be thrown into the river. And this is the predicament that this couple finds themselves in. And you know it, you know what's going to happen. The baby that's born, is it a girl or a boy? It's a boy. The author's already setting us up. It's already shown us the conflict that's going to happen. And sure enough, the woman, she gazes into this baby's face. There was no way she could do anything like the Egyptians wanted them to do. No way. When she looked at her baby, she didn't see an animal. She didn't see a clump of cells. She looked at this baby and she saw a treasure. She saw a gift from God. She looked at this baby and she saw a future for this baby. And she was convinced that God had something special for this child's life. So they decided, you know, they're not going to be able to obey Pharaoh. So they decided they were going to, as long as they could, hide the baby. I don't know how realistic that was in thinking, because it's really hard to hide a baby. They cry a lot. Having a 3-year-old and an almost 1-year-old, and my wife being out of town for the last few days, babies cry a lot. And so this was a labor for them, to hide the baby from the Egyptians. And I'm sure the soldiers would make their rounds every so often. And these parents, they had to be on their toes. They had to always be ready to respond if there was some kind of threat in the area. And of course, as the baby grew, so did the capacity of his lungs. So did the capacity for him to scream and scream and scream. So they did this. They kept this up for 3 months, which is really, really impressive. But they finally get to the point that they realize they're not going to be able to keep this up any longer. They're not going to be able to protect him. They're not going to be able to watch out for their child and defend him like they wish they could. And they knew that it was only a matter of time until that little boy screamed or cried at the wrong time, when the wrong person was around. And when that happened, they knew that the soldiers would come, they would seize that baby, and they would forcibly drown him in the Nile River. So what could they do? They've done everything humanly possible up to this point for 3 months, watching, listening, doing everything they can. And they're stuck. They've got no other option. Now, for us, we've heard stories of people abandoning their babies on doorsteps or sometimes in a car in a parking lot or whatever. And the idea behind that sometimes is that people have the baby, the mother has the baby, and they think that they can get a better life for this baby by giving him away to someone else. The mother in this story has likely heard stories of people doing a similar thing like that, but people actually taking the baby, putting it in a basket, and putting it on a body of water for someone to come and take, just putting it somewhere in a public spot so someone could find that. There's several stories of that happening, apart from Moses himself. There's several stories of that happening in the ancient Near East. So if this little guy, this precious baby boy, if he was going to survive, they were going to have to do something drastic. So what the mother did is she took this baby, knowing her own human limitations, she took this baby. She placed him completely in God's hands. Which, by the way, is what we're all supposed to do with our kids. When it comes down to it, technically speaking, they're not ours. They're God's. And from the moment they're born, they should be sanctified for God's purpose. We can't sovereignly protect them all their life. We do everything we can. We dedicate them to the Lord. But ultimately, they're his. He has to take care of them. Now we get to the part of the story where we have to give the caption, "Don't try this at home." She takes a basket from the corner of her house somewhere, this homemade basket made out of the reeds that had come from the river, and she waterproofed it with some kind of pitch that they had local there. And you know she had to have taken a deep breath as she placed that baby, laid him in that little basket. But the hardest part was still yet to come. She still had to make that trek to the river. She had to go down the bank and eventually not only place that in the river, she had to let it go That was going to be the hardest part. I mean, they had feared God. Remember, they had feared God. The whole reason that they didn't do this with their baby, when I'm sure there were probably other Israelites that were doing this, is because they feared God. They had obeyed Him. They had put their trust in Him. And now it was like, God, are you abandoning us? We've done this for 3 months. Now you're just gonna take a step back and leave us on our own? Had God abandoned them? I can imagine she must have shed all kinds of tears as she put that basket in the water and she let it go. You imagine the fear that was in her heart? But as much as she wanted to, they both understood that they couldn't stay there any longer. They couldn't stand there and watch to see what happened, because it would raise suspicions from people passing by or maybe even the soldiers. So they had to walk away and leave that baby completely in the hands of God. But they did leave their older daughter there. We assume it's Miriam, later from the rest of the five books of the Bible, the first five books of the Bible, but the text doesn't actually say. And this older daughter watches the events unfold from a distance. I'm sure she found a spot where she thought she was in a good hiding spot. She probably had her Groucho Marx glasses and, you know, eyebrows and things on, and so she wouldn't raise suspicion. And after she waited there a while, I mean, her eyes probably bugged out of her head. She couldn't believe what was happening. She couldn't believe who was approaching the bank to go down into the river. See, what she saw, everyone in Egypt would recognize. Everybody around would recognize the colors and the insignias that were on the clothes of these people. And who it was Pharaoh's own daughter, the one that had made this command. It was Pharaoh's own daughter that was approaching the river, going down into the bank, and she was going to bathe there. Now, the Nile River is not like this clear, pristine body of water. That wasn't really the point. The point was, a lot of the Egyptians would do this. They would bathe in the river because they revered the river almost to a point of idolatry, where they had gods of the Nile and gods of the sun and that kind of thing. And so the Nile was just like one of their gods. They depended on the water bringing in all the nutrients and everything for the banks, the surrounding banks, and to grow food for them. And so Pharaoh's daughter, she's taken a bath in the river. She may or may not have walked right past that little basket when she goes in, because it's kind of hidden a little bit in the reeds. But then she sees something. She sees this floating object that didn't look like it naturally fit everything else that was there by the river. And she knew for a fact that crocodiles don't cry, so it couldn't have been a crocodile. And from the river, she calls to the bank, to her servants, and says, "Hey, what is that? Can you see what that is? Can you go get that for me?" So the servants go and they get this basket. They bring it to her, and I'm sure she examines it for a second. And she slowly lifts the lid. Now, me personally, I'm not so sure there's such a thing as an adorable baby that's crying. But she thought so. When she saw this baby, it was like nothing else she'd ever seen. She saw this helpless, vulnerable, precious boy. And he captured her heart immediately. Now, who do you think is behind the compassion that she has for that baby? Who's touched her heart to have compassion on that baby? Who's worked, providentially worked, to make sure that it was a woman and not a rough and tough soldier that found this baby?
And so she starts talking out loud to the servants that are with her. And she says, oh, this must be one of the Hebrews. This is obviously one of the Hebrews' children. And the older sister that was still around and in her spot overhears them, and she sees a window of opportunity. She comes up to this group and she says, oh, would you like me to go and find a Hebrew woman that can nurse the baby for you? And in God's providence, Pharaoh's daughter didn't even deliberate. There wasn't a lot for her to think about. She says, go do it. Go find a woman that can nurse him for me. And the young girl goes, and she finds who? She finds the baby's own mother. And Pharaoh's daughter doesn't have a clue who this is. She works out an arrangement with this random Hebrew woman to take care of this baby, and she even pays her to do so. Gives her wages. Not only had the baby been protected and taken in by Pharaoh's own house, the one who was wanting all the baby boys to be killed, not only was he taken into Pharaoh's own house, the mother, the baby's own mother, was allowed to raise him. Eventually, you know the story, eventually the baby would grow up. And he went to live in the house of Pharaoh's daughter. And she, apparently, was the one that named him. But even the name here has a double meaning. Because the word for Moses in Egyptian, it meant born of. So this was a common way for people to name their kids for the Egyptians. If you've ever heard of some of the famous Egyptian pharaohs, like Thutmose or Ramesses, it actually has that word from Moses in there. Thutmose, it's from that same word. It means to be born of, and then the prefix of that word is the god Thoth. So born of the god Thoth, Thutmose. And with Ramesses, there Ramesses, same word as Moses, born of Ra. Ra was like the sun god for the Egyptians. But she apparently was also familiar with Hebrew, and she names him Moses, which meant to draw out. And so Moses was raised in Pharaoh's own house and was given excellent training and education by Pharaoh, the very one that wanted him dead. And his whole motive was because he didn't want Israel to become too strong to leave. But it's the sense of humor and it's the wisdom of God to take the deliverer and raise him and educate him and train him in Pharaoh's own house. So here we have this story. A hero is born for the children of Israel. There's no fanfare. Okay? And it's done right under Pharaoh's nose. Why? Because God's providence is often subtle, is often quiet. You remember the old show Survivor? I think it came out when I was like in middle school. It was one of those first reality shows. Reality shows, right? You know those aren't real, correct? So it was one of those first reality shows, and there were 16 different castaways that they put on this deserted island, and the last one standing, after they eliminated people, the last one standing would win $1 million, right? So what would always happen is players went into the game with a certain strategy, but you can't have the same rules every season, right? Or it would get boring. So what happens is they would twist the rules around in the middle of the show, and players would have to adapt their strategy to what was happening. We live in a universe where the master strategist never has to adapt. God never has to change his plans. He never has to change his strategy. He knows the end from the beginning. His hands are never tied by the ingenuity of humanity. Never. There's never been a fallen angel or demon or Satan himself that is so clever that could confuse or outwit God. I mean, before the foundation of the world, God had appointed that his son would die. Before mankind had even decided to sin, God had already appointed that it was going to happen, that Jesus was going to die on the cross for sinners. Now, we live in a frame of time right now when most of God's providence is quiet. But listen, God is no less alive, powerful, or active today than he was in the book of Exodus. There are times, and we're definitely going to see it in this book, there are times when God steps into this world and he does jaw-dropping things. He does awesome, miraculous things. However, listen, God reserves the right to providentially move events and work in our lives in a quiet providence as he sees fit. The same God that has every right to change the laws of nature to perform miracles has the right to work quietly and subtly and under our noses. A lot of things could have gone wrong in this episode in chapter 2, verses 1 through 10. A lot of things. The baby could have been found on day 2 after his birth. Someone could have been gossiping around the neighborhood that, oh yeah, these folks down the road, yeah, they've got a baby that they're hiding, and the wrong person might have heard it. There certainly, I'm sure, was danger on the river placing him there, and anybody could have found that baby. Anything could have gone wrong, but what was happening, God was providentially working in a quiet manner. Now, even though a deliverer has been born, there's a hero in place in the world that's going to deliver Israel. The hero is on the scene, but listen, it's going to be another 80 years before the children of Israel ever leave Egypt. 80 more years. All right, here's some quick ways that we see the providence of God in this passage. These are things that even happen in our own lives, under our noses, that we may not always appreciate. What I mean by this is that there are things that happen in our life where God puts them there because he is training us. All right? He may be educating us on something in order that we can encourage someone else down the road. Sometimes he allows us to go through things so that we can be comforters and help people down the road. Those things that might be our biggest fears might be exactly what God uses. Our circumstances and our life experiences, as bad as they may be the way that God is going to give you to minister to people. So it's not necessarily this thing where you've been victimized and you have to always hide it for the rest of your life. No, God wants you to use that thing because he has, whether we like it or not, he has allowed the events that have occurred in our life. Now, what are some of the things or some of the ways we see God's providence in this passage? Well, his family history. It's not going to matter a whole lot these first 80 years, but when you get to the rest of Exodus and when you get into Numbers, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy, it's going to matter that he and his brother are from the tribe of Levi. Okay? So you see his family history. Another way we see God's providence is in human limitations. If Moses' mother and father could have taken care of him for until he was 3 or 4 years old, if they could have hid him, he would not have ended up in Pharaoh's house. Getting the education that he got. And Moses benefited from that education. We benefited from that education. Moses learned literary styles and that kind of thing, which he eventually used in penning the first 5 books of the Bible. Another way we see God's providence is just in love and compassion. that the family had for one another and that they had for this baby and God working in the heart of Pharaoh's daughter. We see God's providence through good parenting. Here is probably Miriam. She's a sharp kid. She saw a window of opportunity and she jumped on it. She had a lot of wisdom for however old she was. So, good parenting. Another way we see God's providence in this passage is through irony or sense of humor. Because this account, these 10 verses, is filled with irony. Remember, the baby boy is placed in the water, just like the edict said. They were supposed to cast their babies in the water, which, you know, technically speaking, they kind of sort of did. Another way we see irony here is God's instrument of deliverance will be educated and raised in Pharaoh's own house. Another way we see irony, the Egyptians, they nearly worshipped the Nile River. But I love this. As we go through Exodus, you know what we're going to see? We're going to see in the book of Exodus, we're going to see water turning on the Egyptians in so many ways. And this is just the first instance. God is working in powerful ways, and it's usually under our very noses. So we don't belittle the little things that we, our little responsibilities that we do day in and day out. You know, my mom and dad lived consistent lives with how they loved people and the kind of ministry that they did. There was nothing spectacular. They never had put on an event where thousands of people came and hundreds of people came and walked the aisles. But I saw consistent examples in my lifetime of how you're supposed to love Jesus, how you're supposed to love your kids, how you're supposed to be a responsible parent. And out of that, I have four other siblings, and pretty much all of us are in some kind of profession where we help people. It's providence of God. Don't belittle being a good spouse and being a good parent day in and day out. Being great at that and maybe not so great on what others see at work. Just a simple thing like treating people with kindness is a way that God works, is a way that God points people to Jesus. Slowing down in your life in the different environments that you're at, whether it's at school, whether it's at work, and at home, your neighborhood, slowing down and just being aware of what's going on around you. You know, when we're so fixated on social media, putting out a certain persona on our Twitter or Instagram or whatever, we can be so fixated on that we're missing the ministry that God's put around us all over the place. And we have to slow down to have an awareness of what's going on around us. Like last night, we met together at the mall. And we were just going to pray and find ways for us to be a blessing to people. And maybe pray for someone and share the gospel. All we did last night was live our lives, but we were just being more intentional. We slowed down to look for opportunities. Another way God works in providence is being able to sympathize with people. I understand, you work a job Monday through Friday where people are just getting on your nerves, and I work retail Monday through Friday, it's easy to want to just come home and be in your little shell, right? But we can never lose the sympathy and the compassion that Jesus had for people. What happens is that Christians, we want this burning bush experience every day. And because we don't get this burning bush experience, we get mad with God. Or even worse, we put on a show to make it look like we've had this burning bush experience every day. But God, listen, God does more with simple encounters with you reading Scripture and praying with Him than He does in these fantastic, huge things that we want to make up in our minds. It's the simple things, the simple ways that God works and He develops believers and He develops us into the image of Christ. Now, I only shared a part of those lyrics of that song that I mentioned earlier, In the Waiting. I've seen the blooms of spring, new life and everything, but now it seems so gray, bright colors fade away. This winter seems much longer and colder than before. I want to share the rest of those lyrics. I want to play that song for you, and the lyrics will be on the screen. I want you to hear the rest of the words. I really believe that it may be a blessing to someone this morning.
I've seen the Red Sea part. I've seen the mountains move. But now it seems so dark. I can't even feel you. If you choose to be silent, then I'll be silent too. I will worship in the waiting, quiet before you. Until your voice, like manna from the sky. I will
So I don't want you to be discouraged. If you're here this morning and you're just discouraged, like, oh, my life isn't like so-and-so. They seem to have, you know, God do this huge thing like every hour of their day. Listen, God does so much more in the subtle things. And if we could appreciate what he's doing and the things that are under our noses, the people that he's put into our lives, the opportunities that we have, we can worship him better. Because I feel like we'll have better expectations of how he works. Now, again, I'm not belittling, and I'm definitely not saying God doesn't step in and do incredible supernatural things. He does. He absolutely does. And we should pray, and we should seek his face, and we should ask him to do those things. And at times, he will. He will. But we can't be discouraged, and we can't get off track when he's just working through quiet subtleties of life.